and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters I find in it, at their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games and have fun. We've got a lot of great monsters for you in this episode, but before we get started, I want to take the time to thank some new patrons and read some new listener mail. Okay, let's start by thanking our patrons. These are the people who have gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 to support this show and help defray some of its expenses. Those who pledge at the $2 level and above get access to my new show, Patron Deities, the first two episodes of which you can check out here in the Monster Man feed completely free. So, thank you to Tim Deegan, Edwin King, and Justin Woodman. Thanks, everyone. Okay, let's take a look at our listener mail. And in fact, our first message is from the aforementioned Edwin King. Edwin writes, "As well as the hellhound in blues music, you might consider the cultural influence of Francis Thompson's 1890s poem, The Hound of Heaven." And he quotes from it, "I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears, I hid from him and under running laughter." And so on for almost 200 lines. Of course, it turns out that the Hound is not a terrible doom, but instead a representation of God's implacable will. This has been cited as influential on Tolkien, but I don't know the evidence of this, maybe just because he was a Catholic. And it certainly had an influence on types of English Catholic romanticists, such as G.K. Chesterton. And of course, there's the Hound of the Baskervilles, but perhaps you covered that in the Shuck Legends. I enjoyed your description on hyenas in the Knoll episode. It made me think of the giggling psychos that Richard Widmark played as a young man. Yeah, I think that's a good one. I think the Frostgrave Knolls have caught the hyena nest nicely, and here he's referring to the plastic Knoll miniatures. They're multi-part plastics produced by North Star for the miniatures game Frostgrave. And yeah, they're pretty great. I actually don't have any. I have every other Frostgrave set, but I don't have the Knolls. One of these days, you know, I should put it on my wish list. Okay, thanks for writing in, Edwin. I think that is a really good point, the way that God's will is represented here as being kind of, you know, implacable and unstoppable, which of course could be both good or bad, depending on your kind of perceived relationship to the divine. And we've talked about this before in the case of lawful evil devils, that they actually are sort of on the side of the gods, in that their role is to punish sinners, although we will see that this is not necessarily true later on in this episode. My next email is from Goblin's Henchman, who quickly wanted to talk about the herd animals. He says, "I think they're mainly in the book to act as a baseline, especially back in the day before we all had some idea about monsters and their relative powers. Without a herd animal or the like, how would you know how relatively powerful a basilisk is?" I guess the answer to that would be, how powerful is it compared to a player character, right? But no, I mean, I take the point. And certainly in our most recent episode, you can see that things like horses are super valuable. And again, I think this is in line with the idea that I was going to say that the Dungeon Master's Guide doesn't know what its purpose is, but it would be more accurate, I think, to say that it serves multiple purposes. And one of those is, as you say, a descriptive baseline about the game world. Okay, well, thanks for writing in, everybody. I also wanted to say thank you to everyone who's written in offering to lend, or in one case give me, their copies of the old Deities and Demigods book. Now, of course, I have a Deities and Demigods book for my podcast, Patron Deities, but it's the third printing, which doesn't have the Cthulhu Mythos and Melnibonean stuff in it. So people who have access to those have been offering to help me out, which I really appreciate. So I'll be in touch with everybody who's written in, but I just wanted to say how much I greatly appreciate the listeners' willingness to help out. You know, yada yada, community spirit, yada yada. Thanks a lot, guys. That sounds flippant, but I really mean it. All right, let's look at some monsters. And we're starting off with a doozy. It is the Imp. So the Imp is like a little devil, and it's sort of a witch's familiar. It's a very minor devil created to spread evil in the form of a familiar to a lawful evil magic user or cleric. And historically, an Imp is what they would also call a familiar of a witch. Now, Imp comes from a word that probably means something like offshoot, and it came to mean child. So if you hear someone being called like an Imp of Satan or an imp of hell, that just means like a child of the devil. But gradually, it came to mean specifically a small devil. But the childlike relationship continues. So if you look at witch trials from the 17th century, they often include witches referring to their familiars or their imps, as they sometimes called them, as being like their children. Let's do a brief digression about witch trials. So, in England, the boom period of witch trials is in, like, the 1640s. It's during the Civil War, or the War of the Three Kingdoms, as it's also called. And part of that is to do with the social unrest at that time, and part of that is to do with a change in the law that happens in 1604. And what happens is when that Witchcraft Act is passed, is that it becomes illegal to do sorcery per se. That is to say, previously, the crime used to be that you had harmed someone magically. But in 1604, just making a compact with spirits becomes a crime. And so, all you had to do in order to prove witchcraft was bully an old lady into a confession, rather than prove that someone had been harmed by witchcraft. Anyway, imps are great. Now, the book says that an imp, so it provides a bunch of benefits to its master, gives them various powers and helps them out. And it says that they can polymorph into a large spider, a raven, a giant rat, or a goat. And those are all great witch's familiar forms, but I do feel like they're missing some tricks. Let's take a look at some actual witch's familiars. Now, this is from the trial of a woman named Ursley or Ursula Kemp, alias Grey, and she is being accused of committing 3 murders by witchcraft. This is in 1582. So this is from the trial records, or the confession records. The said Ursley, bursting out with weeping, fell upon her knees and confessed that she had 4 spirits, whereof 2 of them were he's and the other 2 were she's. The 2 he spirits were to punish and kill unto death, and the other 2 she's were to punish with lameness and other diseases of bodily harm, and also to destroy cattle. And she, this examinate, being asked by what name or names she called the said spirits, and what manner of things or color they were of, confesseth and saith that the one is called Titty, being a he, and is like a gray cat. The second, called Jack, also a he, and is like a black cat. The third is called Pigeon, being a she, and is like a black toad. And the fourth is called Tiffin, being a she, and is like a white lamb. Yeah, so no toad. You'd think we get a toad for a familiar form of an imp, right? Anyway, notice also that one of them is called Jack, which is not a very exciting name for a familiar, but not uncommon. There's another case where we have familiars called Jack and a Jill. And in the trial of accused witch John Chambers, the toad-shaped imp that Chambers used was called John. And it's not uncommon for some of the imps to have the same name as their master, which kind of gives the impression that they're sort of like an expression of the master's spirit. So that's kind of interesting. Some more exciting imps come from the trials of Elizabeth Clark and Rebecca West. And these two are well-known because they were tried by the infamous... Well, not tried. They were investigated by the infamous Matthew Hopkins, the so-called Witch Finder General, about whom I could and indeed have say more at length. Yeah, maybe I'll put my witch trials thing up in this podcast feed if anybody's interested in hearing it. It's not really gaming related, but it could be fun. I gave a talk about witch trials some years ago now. Maybe that could be some Patreon bonus content, huh? Now, the case of Elizabeth Clark is interesting because Hopkins and Stern, his partner, testified that they actually saw the imps. But listen to this description. I'm reading from Malcolm Gaskell's book, Witchfinders, a 17th Century English Tragedy, which is a very good one-volume look at the careers of Hopkins and Stern. Smacking her lips with a kissing noise, Clark called out the name, Holt, in a sing-song voice, as one might call a cat for its supper. Nothing happened and nobody moved. For the next half hour, an air of tense expectation hung in the room, but it seemed that whatever display the old widow had planned was just a figment of her imagination. Then Hopkins, Stern, and the other watchers became aware of another presence. Before their eyes crept a white creature, like a cat, but smaller, which silently greeted its mistress before retreating into the shadows. So, a cat, then. So what's like a cat but smaller? A kitten. I continue. Next she called, Jermara. According to Hopkins, there appeared an imp like to a dog, which was white with some sandy spots, and seemed to be very fat and plump with very short legs, who forthwith vanished away. So a fat dog. The one after that, Vinegar Tom, Stern described as like a greyhound with legs as long as a stag. There followed an imp resembling a polecat or ferret, that one's called News, and one like a toad, which doesn't seem to mention a name. And she also had a black imp called Sack and Sugar, and that seems to be, according to the illustration, a black rabbit, although... Yeah, so these just seem like ordinary animals, and Vinegar Tom is represented as having bull horns in this illustration, but I don't know that that's actually in the description. So that was Elizabeth Clark, and then Rebecca West's imps have much more exciting names. They're called Isle Mouser Pie-Wacket, Peckin' the Crown, or Pawkin' the Crown, and Grizzel Greedy Gut. So those are pretty cool. Yeah, so Sack and Sugar does appear to be a rabbit. Yeah. And then Clark told Stern that he was lucky that Sack and Sugar hadn't leapt onto his face, crawled down his throat, and deposited, quote, a feast of toads, close quotes, into his belly. So says Gaskell. So they seem very much like ordinary animals, which, you know, goes toward our idea that imps can polymorph. So imps, I mean, I don't think I have anything to say about them. They're great. Harmless old cat lady. She's got a bunch of cats. You know, oh, our wacky cat lady neighbor. Oh, she's a witch. Now, this is a little messed up because, of course, in Dungeons & Dragons, she really is a witch and she really is dangerous. Whereas, you know, in real life, she's a harmless old woman being bullied into a confession and ultimately death by a ruthless opportunist. But it's not like we don't make adventure material out of grislier and more unjust subjects in Dungeons & Dragons. You just gotta kind of make sure you keep the history and the fantasy separated. Anyway, imps. A-plus monsters. Real gold star material. All right, next up. Wow, what a contrast, because the next monster on our list is the Intellect Devourer. So we have next to, you know, side by side, a historical monster that people in the 17th century appear to have genuinely believed in, and some bonkers sci-fi nonsense. I love the Intellect Devourer because it is a big brain on legs, and because it wears people's bodies around, and it hits you with its paws, and it's a big brain on legs. Now, a big part of the Intellect Devourer being an excellent monster is that, unlike a lot of the other psychic monsters that we've run into so far, it has an absolutely stunning illustration. Now, Dave Trompier has outdone himself. Man, did a pretty good job on the imp, too. Really looks like someone, you know, someone who believed in imps might have drawn. So, two for two there, Dave. But yeah, this Intellect Devourer looks absolutely swell. It's a big brain with, like, dog legs, but really messed up looking ones, and it's splendid. And these are another example of the monster genre where the monster is trying to inform you that the psionic rules are important, because the easiest way to beat them is probably psionically. They're actually not that tough as psychics, and they run away, and you can find them in other planes, and yeah, anyway. So, but they psychically attack people, and then they house themselves inside those people's emptied bodies once their minds are destroyed. So they're gross looking. They have an unusual mechanic for when they attack. And then they pilot people around, I guess just waiting to pounce again. I'm not sure what the agenda is there, but you know, whatever. They're very intelligent, they're chaotic evil, so they're absolutely bang-up monsters, and they're a great answer to the question of why your friend or contact is acting so funny. Then we've got the Invisible Stalker. It stalks you, and it's invisible. That's kind of it. They're basically henchmen for bad guys. They're intelligent, but, you know, mainly they get conjured and sent out on jobs. They don't have an illustration because they're invisible. And later monster manuals actually just have, like, a square next to the thing, but it's empty because the creature's invisible. Lol, lol, lol. They're fine. You know, but they're more of a challenge and fight monster than a monster with a lot of narrative potential. Not that there's anything wrong with that. They're another tool in a bad guy's arsenal. But what's cool about them really comes from the coolness of whoever it is that is sending them to go rough up your PCs, whether that's, you know, an evil wizard or a vampire or a mind flayer or whatever it might be. So invisible stalkers, they're fine, but, you know, kind of necessarily because they're invisible and so on, they're not very characterful. Not that you couldn't give one a personality. I mean, they're intelligent, they're like people. So if you're going to include an invisible stalker, you know, just give him a little bit of a personality, give him some quirks. And actually, that could be a lot of fun for the players when they start to realize that, you know, oh, all these murders are being carried out by the same person, but there's no evidence left behind. It's an invisible stalker, but it's an invisible stalker with some weird quirks. That could be kind of fun. Next, we have the Irish deer. It's a deer, but it's very large. Irish deer, kind of a, like, traditional name for these things. They're also sometimes called Irish elk or giant deer. You don't only find them in Ireland. You get them, actually, in lots of different places. They're deer, and they're very big. They have very big antlers. When you look at the antlers, they look absurdly big. But there is actually a whole biological argument about how, you know, they're not disproportionate. It's just that large animals tend to have their large features exaggerated even more. There is a term for this, but I'm not a biologist. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, they're quite cool. They're, again, kind of telling you, like, look at our, you know, primeval woodland. You can see that they're the kind of thing that you might, you know, you might run into when you're lost in the forest primeval, just to kind of warn you that that stuff's up. They're pretty tough, but not, like, amazingly tough. And they're really kind of there to, you know, they're, apart from being good eaten or whatever, they're also sort of a warning shot to warn you that also there are probably dire bears
around somewhere, or cave bears.
And then here's another one of these contrasts. We go from genuine prehistoric megafauna to the Ixchichachitl, which is kind of like, I assume, has a sort of Nahuatl-style pronunciation. So Ixchichachitl. And this is an intelligent manta ray, but with like a barbed stinger. And for every 20 of them, there's a 50% chance that one of them will be vampiric. So they are vampiric manta rays, and a lot of them are clerics, so they're very religious. Ixchichachitl are one of those you love them or you hate them monsters, I think, because I see what there is to love about them. They are pure gonzo, and you can go from one moment frolicking with elves and leprechauns and dryads in the woods, and the next moment you're, you know, wading in the shallows to hack at intelligent vampire manta ray priests with your hand axe. And there's a certain goofy charm to that. I suspect there is a good Ixchichachitl scenario to be written. There may already have been one. I know that they are one of the creatures created for the Blackmoor supplement by Dave Arneson. The kind of hunch that I'm getting is that a lot of the zanier creatures come from there. I mean, not all, by any means exclusively, but certainly kind of getting that impression. Yeah, the Ixchichachitl, I think they're interesting. I think one thing you could do with them is just kind of emphasize how bonkers they are. You know, they don't have hands. I guess they have cleric powers. So I suppose that the cleric ones could summon enough various other creatures to do all their kind of scut work for them, right? So they must have kind of a slave society of some kind, I guess, or a summoned creature society. They even have magic items, although it specifies that they're, you know, they're in their coral reef lairs. They only have the kinds of magic items that you can use without hands, which kind of leaves out a lot of them. No rings for these guys. But how do they, I mean, yeah, the no hands thing is really kind of getting in the way. I guess they sort of do everything with magic, and the rest of them are just, you know, must be the servants of the ones that have the magic necessary to do stuff. I know that in some of the texts that the deity they're clerics of is Demogorgon, which kind of actually makes it work because Demogorgon is this, as we discussed way back in the D episode, in the demons episode, Demogorgon is a bizarre fusion of different things who looks just like completely grotesque and kind of impractically and pathetically grotesque, and yet is still frightening. And you could kind of go that way with the Ixchichachitl. I think you would just have to, you know, play up the way in which their environment makes them not ridiculous. So it's all too easy to say, like, well, I'll tell you what, I'm just going to walk up onto the beach, tough guy, you know, catch me then. So you have to put them in an environment where, you know, they've got your Aunt Sally and she's down in their coral reef lair and they're keeping her alive. But once they find the location of the sunken treasure, then they're going to kill her. So you need to hurry. You need to, you know, the scenario itself needs to provide the inducement to go down into their alien terrain where the fact that they're flat fish with big doofy teeth is actually an advantage and not a disadvantage. And then, you know, then it could really be an uphill battle and you'd sort of regret laughing at the Ixchichachitl. Yeah, I guess that's how you would approach it. I don't know if you have ever played, you know, Vampire the Masquerade or Vampire the Requiem, but one of the powers that vampires can get in those games is they can turn into animals. You know, obviously, classically, vampires turn into things like bats or wolves. But in both games, it's possible to be able to turn into other kinds of animals, and this always leads to some player who wants to turn into an ostrich or a crocodile, you know, a koala bear or whatever it might be. And so the conversation always ends up with having to establish some kind of rule for what a vampire can and cannot turn into. And the rule that I was taught, and I don't even remember who told me this, is if it would look stupid with fangs, a vampire can't turn into it. And unfortunately, I think that the illustration in this entry shows that the Ixchichachitl looks stupid with fangs. It looks pretty dumb. It looks like it's gonna flap up on you and just kind of gnaw you. So there has to be a real conscious effort to turn that absurdity into weirdness and horror. And if you can do that, then I think the Ixchichachitl can work. Okay, that was a long episode, but I wanted to cover all the eye monsters because I didn't think that they would make two episodes. And also, it's Christmas. You know, I realize technically when this episode will be going up, Christmas was yesterday, but nonetheless, I hope that you and yours have had a safe and happy holiday season, and I hope that you will stay with us in the coming new year, when there's going to be lots of exciting new Monster Man material for you guys to enjoy. This has been Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.